The Federal Equal Rights Amendment passed in the New York State Legislature in 1972. Yet in 1975, voters rejected an identically worded state equal rights amendment. What had happened? How did this initial support for the ERA transform into rejection in just 3 short years? The answer can be found in conservative women's grassroots activism against the ERA. Conservative women formed a well-organized network of activists that reversed the fortunes of the ERA in New York. The significance of their efforts was not limited to state politics. Their success in defeating the state ERA was seen as having national ramifications for the federal ERA. In order to understand the development of the anti-ERA movement in New York, we must begin with how the ERA became an issue in the first place. In March 1972, Congress passed the federal ERA, nearly 50 years after the amendment was first proposed. The New York State Legislature rushed to ratify the federal ERA. The legislators were in such a hurry, they didn't follow the usual procedures or allow time for debates or public hearings. In their haste, the legislators were careless and they made procedural mistakes. They had to repeat the entire ratification process over again 3 weeks later in April. The New York State Legislature's haste in ratifying the federal ERA was part of a national trend regarding that amendment. Across the nation, state legislators competed to be the first state to ratify, or among the first. Nationwide, the race to ratify revealed the confidence of most state legislators that all women would embrace the ERA. This hasty ratification ended up becoming a major grievance in some states. In New York, the rush to ratify helped to mobilize conservative women against the ERA. In fact, in the 3 weeks between the first and second attempts to ratify the federal ERA in New York, state legislators received anti-ERA mail from constituents. Some legislators changed their votes as a result. Such individual acts of anti-ERA activity would coalesce into an organized grassroots movement as the state legislature continued to engage with the issue of equal rights for women. In the spring of 1974, some state legislators proposed adding a state ERA to the state constitution. The proposed state ERA would use the very same language as the federal ERA. The usual procedure for a proposed amendment to the state constitution is for the bill proposing the amendment to be passed by 2 consecutive meetings of the state legislature, 1 year apart. After the second passage of the bill, it becomes a referendum on the state ballot for the voters to approve or reject. If the voters approve the referendum, it becomes an amendment to the state constitution. The state legislature initially passed the bill proposing a state ERA in the spring of 1974. By this time, state legislators were aware that public opinion was divided regarding the ERA. Given this, it may seem surprising that they were willing to pass the proposed state ERA this first time. However, whether they supported or opposed the federal ERA, state legislators could all agree on the usefulness of a state ERA as a means of influencing the battle over the federal ERA. State Senate floor debates in May 1974 centered around the idea of using the state ERA as a referendum on the federal ERA. Pro-ERA state senators hoped to enhance New York's image as a leader in supporting the federal ERA and to encourage other states to ratify. By contrast, anti-ERA state senators wanted to provide voters with a chance to express their displeasure about the federal ERA. The state assembly's debates a month earlier, in April 1974, were even more direct on this point. Assemblyman John Esposito, a conservative party member, wanted to speed up the process of putting the state ERA on the ballot for the voters to decide. He proposed circumventing the usual procedure by holding a state referendum on the ERA after it had only been passed once by the state legislature. As he explained with surprising candor, giving the voters a chance to reject the state ERA a year sooner would allow the voters to influence the fate of the federal amendment by sending an anti-ERA message to the nation. However, it seems that anti-ERA state legislators did not do an effective job of communicating their plans to the women of New York. As a result, conservative women feared that the state legislature was about to foist a state ERA upon voters with potentially disastrous results for women, the family, and society. conservative women were galvanized into taking action. Previously, they had limited their protests to unorganized individual acts of expression, such as writing letters to newspapers or calling into radio shows to express their views. With the initial passage of the New York State ERA in 1974 and a second vote looming in 1975, conservative women in New York mobilized an organized grassroots anti-ERA campaign. One of their leaders was Annette Stern. As Annette Stern later recalled, her political awakening occurred one day at her home in Harrison, New York. As the suburban housewife and mother of three went about her daily routine, she heard feminist Betty Friedan speaking on the radio, claiming, quote, to represent American womanhood, end quote. Friedan's comments appalled Stern. Friedan supported ratification of the ERA and argued that women should be liberated from housework and childcare responsibilities. Quote, as if the home were prison and the care of children were slavery, Stern later commented. She felt disturbed at the idea that the media and others might believe that Friedan spoke for all women. Stern felt compelled to contact the radio station to protest, expressing her own reasons for opposition to the ERA. Not content to stop there, Stern sought to reach a larger audience with her message. Stern founded her own anti-ERA organization in the spring of 1974, Women United to Defend Existing Rights, also known as WONDER. She began a series of fundraising drives at cocktail parties, garage sales, coffee clatches, and other events. In effect, Stern drew upon her pre-existing social network of friends and neighbors to recruit like-minded potential activists. She used familiar forms of sociability to spread her message and garner support. In the summer of 1974, the idea was born for a coalition of anti-ERA organizations to be named Operation Wake Up. On December 8, 1974, Stern and members of WONDER hosted a meeting at the Hotel Biltmore in New York City in order to begin a local chapter of WONDER and to add more organizations to Operation Wake Up's coalition, which had mushroomed from 3 to 24 organizations in 6 months. By the leadership's own description, Operation Wake Up was a grassroots, pro-family women's movement. In 1975, the New York Times concurred, describing the coalition as a grassroots effort and stating, quote, Operation Wake Up has no headquarters and is run out of the homes of several members. According to Stern, Operation Wake Up had 100,000 active members at this time. Annette Stern's transformation from housewife to activist is one example of a larger trend happening throughout New York. Sociologist Kathleen Blee has noted that most scholarship on social movements has focused on traditionally male arenas or male leaders. Women's activism, especially in non-feminist causes, scholars have tended to regard as either irrational or performed on behalf of the men in their lives. Annette Stern and other women like her challenge these conceptions and offer an example of anti-feminist activists acting in their own perceived best interests. In the ERA battle, women's activism occurred on both the left and the right. Annette Stern's story may not be representative of anti-ERA women activists in some respects. Rather than Stern's individual decision to start her own organization, some conservative women appear to have been introduced into political activism through a network of family, friends, and neighbors. This is a pathway to activism that scholar Julia Wrigley has identified as more typical for women than men, who may find their way to activism through their workplace experiences. Anti-ERA organizations' offerings of training sessions in anti-ERA information, debate, and public speaking appear to have been intended for such women who were new to political activism. Other women who became involved in anti-ERA activism seem to have already been involved in political or community organizations. Sometimes their husbands' political involvement linked them to additional organizations. For example, Carol Lugosima, founder of Women for Honest Equality in Our Nation, or WEN, was also a member of the League of Women Voters. Her husband belonged to the AFL-CIO. She was outraged that these two organizations were on record as being pro-ERA without having polled their members in order to represent member opinion accurately. The prior experiences of such women enabled them to develop skills and leadership ability that they could draw on in the anti-ERA battle, and they tended to assume positions of leadership within the anti-ERA movement. Beyond the groups formed specifically to fight the ERA, there was also a larger interlocking network of conservative women and men activists in New York at the time, of which some anti-ERA women were a part. For example, Wilson Price was the chairman of the Westchester County Conservative Party. He worked with the Young Americans for Freedom. His wife belonged to the anti-ERA group Operation Wake Up. This is just one example of how three groups could intersect all through one married couple. The anti-ERA organizations that sprang up from 1972 to 1975 seem to have ranged from small neighborhood groups to statewide organizations and coalitions with national ties. There appears to have been a dense and often tangled web of connections, sometimes through overlapping memberships, sometimes through coalitions, and sometimes through the sharing of resources. On the smaller side were organizations such as the Greenberg Homeowners Against ERA, which was linked to other organizations, such as the White Collar Women's Coalition and the Safer Woods Safety Council. On the larger scale were organizations such as the Metropolitan-based Wonder, which was linked to the statewide coalition Operation Wake Up, which was in turn linked to the national organization Happiness of Womanhood, also known as HOW. Through national organizations such as HOW, resources in one state's anti-ERA battle could be shared with another state's anti-ERA groups. One piece of anti-ERA propaganda that circulated in New York originated with a Texas-based group, Women Who Want to Be Women, or WWWW. Women Who Want to Be Women was linked to several other conservative organizations, including Phyllis Schlafly's national organization Stop ERA. This piece of campaign literature demonstrates that a national network of anti-ERA activists existed in that a piece created by a Texas group was somehow sent onto and used in the New York campaign, most likely via members of Stop ERA. Members of national anti-ERA organizations sometimes traveled to other states to testify against the ERA, as happened in New York at the hearings of March 1975. National organizations members also seemed more likely to have an awareness of congressional debates on the federal ERA and how the ERA was faring nationally. Let us turn now to consider the anti-ERA arguments used in the ERA battle in New York. Anti-ERA arguments were fully aired during the state legislature's floor debates of 1974 to 75 and the 1975 public hearings on the state ERA. As could be expected, there were many who opposed the ERA on the basis of believing that the ERA threatened the preservation of traditional sex roles and the perceived social and legal benefits women already possessed. Some were either confused about the difference between the federal and state amendments or deliberately chose to use the debate on the state amendment as a forum for criticizing the federal amendment. One legislator warned that the state ERA would mean women would be drafted. Another state legislator pointed out that New York was not in a position to do that. Perhaps most intriguing, some anti-ERA arguments connected the amendment to forced busing. For example, Senator Schermerhorn asked his colleagues, quote, "If we are going to believe in equal distribution in our educational system, in other words, go for busing to achieve a so-called racial balance, why not bus to achieve a sexual balance? Let's even out the boys and girls in the school system. It would be the right thing to do if this bill passes. It may seem like something that is humorous, but believe me, this amendment reaches much farther than you believe." Schermerhorn's argument appeared in the New York State Assembly too. Connecting the ERA to forced busing suggests that attempts to address sexual and racial discrimination were being linked in some minds as similar unwarranted intrusions by the Supreme Court and the federal government into private matters and social issues that could not and should not be legislated. It seems that in a time of political and economic turmoil, insisting on maintaining traditional sex roles was a way to try and rebel against the pace and extent of social change. A related theme that appeared in anti-ERA arguments was trust in government, perhaps unsurprising in the post-Vietnam Watergate era. People said their trust in government to represent their interests had been shaken. The circumstances around the ratification of the federal ERA in New York had confirmed their fears. Now that we have looked at the development of the anti-ERA movement in New York and the most common anti-ERA arguments, I will discuss the results and significance of this activism. The conservative activists achieved a number of goals. They succeeded in lobbying enough state legislators after the 1974 vote that they persuaded the legislators to schedule a public hearing on the state ERA in 1975. During the campaign leading up to the November 1975 election, the activists prevailed in a related lawsuit against the State Division of Women for using public funds to promote a partisan stance on the state ERA referendum. The conservative activists ran what appears to have been an effective campaign despite a meager official budget. When the day of the election finally arrived, voters rejected the state ERA in New York. The fate of the ERA in New York was emphasized by a similar result in neighboring New Jersey, where voters spurned their own proposed state ERA. The New York Times described the outcome as a stunning defeat. New York voters had rebuffed the state ERA by a 60-40 split. The amendment was defeated by a lack of support in upstate New York. Even the most pessimistic of ERA supporters was surprised at this margin of defeat, according to the Newark Star-Ledger. Whether or not the conservative activists contributed decisively to the defeat of the state ERA is difficult to determine conclusively. It is clear that the goal they had worked for was achieved, the defeat of the state ERA. Meanwhile, the anti-ERA activists had been planning ahead. The Star-Ledger reported, opponents of the state ERA had said that if it was defeated, they would mount a drive to get the legislature to rescind its earlier ratification of the federal ERA. The day after the state ERA was defeated, Senator Donovan sent out a memo to the entire New York State Legislature calling for rescission. He wrote, quote, "Now that the people have spoken, it surely becomes incumbent upon their representatives to recall any ratification that took place on this proposal prior to the voters' voices being heard." Donovan and others portrayed rescission as a mechanism to restore the representative nature of government. On April 12, 1976, Mary Burke Nicholas, chair of the New York State Division for Women, received a panicked memo. The memo alerted her to the imminent threat of rescission of the 1972 ratification of the federal ERA. The Assembly Judiciary Committee had a rescission bill on its agenda for April 28. The chairman did not think he would be able to keep the bill in committee. A member of the committee was described as saying, "The situation is touch and go." The memo predicted, quote, "If rescission is voted out of committee, the consensus seems to be that it will pass on the floor of the Assembly. Rescission would face little difficulty in passing the Senate, considering the struggle to obtain second passage in the Senate last year." The author of the memo closed by asking with some desperation, "Can we meet today to discuss this emergency situation?" Clearly, pro-ERA government officials perceived the rescission bill as a serious threat to the ratification of the federal ERA. In just 3 short years, the state legislators of New York had shifted from believing that the majority of their voters would want the ERA to being jolted into awareness that the amendment was a far more controversial issue than they had imagined possible. Both New York and New Jersey state legislatures considered and rejected rescission repeatedly from late 1975 through 1977. Although they did not succeed in their goal of rescinding New York's ratification of the federal ERA, the conservative activists did have an impact on the national debate surrounding the ERA. The defeat of the state ERAs of New York and New Jersey were seen as such a threat to the future success of the federal ERA that a national media mogul sprang into action to counteract the defeat. Cy Chasler, the editor of Red Book, coordinated a publicity campaign for the ERA in 39 national women's magazines with a combined circulation of close to 70 million readers. He organized it so that all of these magazines would publish articles on the ERA in July 1976. His coordinated effort did not have the effect he had hoped for, however, as the various magazines did not all publish a single unified pro-ERA message about the amendment. Furthermore, not all readers were pleased to see these articles. Some opponents of the ERA launched a letter-writing campaign as a protest. Chasler's media blitz in favor of the ERA may not have had the effect he had planned, but it suggests the ongoing nationwide reverberations felt in the aftermath of the defeat of the New York and New Jersey state ERAs in November 1975, even months later. This look at politics and women in New York reveals some larger themes. First, the anti-ERA movement was a grassroots movement with connections to a complex network of a variety of organizations. Second, the conservative impulse revealed in New York's anti-ERA movement included mainstream conservatism, rather than being simply extreme or fanatical. Third, women who mobilized a grassroots anti-ERA movement in New York appear to have succeeded in sending a message to their state legislature and to the nation. Clearly, the defeat of the state ERA revealed a groundswell of discontent with the pace and extent of social change, as arguments linking forced busing and the ERA demonstrate. In conclusion, I would like to quote from sociologist Rebecca Klatch's work on Women of the New Right. Klatch writes, "For those who are concerned about America's shift to the right, it is essential to understand that the new right speaks to real social problems. Too often, those on the left have dismissed the right as being fanatics or pathological. Only to the extent that the issues raised by the right are recognized and addressed is it likely that the rightward tide will be turned." I agree with Klatch. The women of the anti-ERA movement and their arguments may amuse, annoy, or disturb those of us possessed of more centrist or liberal views. However, to dismiss their views is to miss out on a potentially valuable social and political critique embedded in their rhetoric.